Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Douglas Bell. Today, I'll be speaking with Chad Pearson, a lecturer in history at the University of North Texas. We will be discussing his new book, Capital's Terrorist, Klansmen, Lawmen, and Employers in the Long 19th Century, published by the University of North Carolina Press. Chad, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Great. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about your background?
Certainly. So I teach history at the University of North Texas, but I'm not from Texas. I grew up in Rhode Island in the Northeast and went to school in Massachusetts and New York State for graduate school. The last 10, 12 years or so, I taught at a community college, which is very much in the news these days for its lack of free speech protections, a place called Collin College. It's out there. And so I left that institution and now teach at University of North Texas. I identify as a labor historian. I really like, understanding power relations. That's a bit about me.
All right. How did you come to write this book?
So I liked labor history quite a bit. I'm really interested in class conflict broadly defined, and I realized that there was a lot of work on workers, which is great. I love that, but maybe less so about employers and anti-unionism, which is such an important part of history. And so I wrote a previous book on the open shop movement, which is the anti-labor union movement. There's still so much more to say. These people, these business people and their allies, so interesting. And I wanted to really look at, the central question I had was, what are the forces in society that make the lives of ordinary people miserable? And so that's the sort of overarching question, and I explored that in some graphic detail, and wanted to see these different managerial techniques. One thing that sort of gets my goat a lot is the use of the passive voice when describing these things. Wages were low, conditions were bad. Right. I wanted to shine a spotlight on the folks responsible for giving ordinary people, that is working class people, a hard time.
Right. So in your book, these are the people who are, you call the terrorist, I guess. So who are the terrorists?
The terrorists, yes. So I sought to really save the word terrorism from the Islamophobes. And I know terrorism is both a provocative word and a slippery word, right? It's provocative. It's, sort of gets your attention. It's slippery because, there's a saying, one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. And so I recognized that there was some scholarship that looked at working class expressions of working class radicalism as examples of terrorism. Fair enough. You're bombing things. There's no doubt about that. But what about when employers and other elites were involved in violent activity, right? In the scholarship, we seldom see historians identify them in that word. But if you look at the language of workers who experienced some of the worst types of anti-union violence, they did use the word terrorism and terrorist to describe these people. So the people I'm interested in include members of the Ku Klux Klan in the Reconstruction period. Now, I don't think any person is going to push back against that. That's clear. They're terrorists. But I also argue that they were kind of like employers. We'll get into that in a little bit. I also look at organized businessmen who were involved in various vigilante activities, right, including kidnapping and murder, right? That seems to be terrorism to me, to achieve a political end, to use violence to achieve a political end. And I look at stock growers in the West who are involved in violent activities, and business people of at various levels. So these are the folks who I identify very provocatively as terrorists.
All right. Yeah. So in addition to your terrorists, you have other categories of people who are around the terrorist, people you call enablers and narrative makers. So who are these groups and how do they kind of facilitate the behaviors of the terrorist?
Certainly. So I guess I'm somewhat of an old-fashioned Marxist in that I believe that the state, that is the federal, state, and local governments, generally serve the interests of those people at the top of society. And so we're talking about judges, politicians, the police, the National Guard, federal troops. And so these were the folks who, in the context of labor management confrontations, generally, though there were exceptions, generally sided with management, okay? That might mean injunctions, that might mean cops beating strikers, that might mean National Guardsmen shutting down things. And so I refer to these people as the enablers. And so they enable a lot of inequality in society. And they also sort of look the other way when the terrorists I'm interested in, these were the folks from the private sector, were engaged in various union busting activities. And so judges were more inclined to fine or jail striking workers than they were to discipline or punish elites, bosses who are involved in actual, confrontations, physical confrontations with workers. And so I refer to these folks in the public sector as the enablers. And then the narrative creators, another category I describe in the book, are were the folks who wrote about labor management confrontations or wrote about business and labor. And I'm talking about journalists, I'm talking about clergymen, and in some cases, even novelists. And so these were the folks who sort of legitimized what I call the terrorist by referring to them as good citizens and referring to workers who were engaged in unrest as sort of the dangerous classes. And so there were lots and lots of publications that were explicitly anti-union and created a narrative that shaped the consciousness, I think, of many ordinary people, that is readers. And so so I'm interested chiefly in the terrorists. I look at their enablers, and I look at the narrative creators who seek to, again, legitimize this climate of repression.
Right. And so these individuals all kind of, at least the terrorists especially, you discuss them using three different types of violence, hard, soft, and hybrid. So can you maybe go into a bit of detail about the differences of the violence that you're looking at?
Certainly. I like the question. So a hard form of violence would be kidnapping, beating, killing. These are physically abusive forms of methods designed to terrorize workers and to eliminate the threat, certainly in the case of, say, a lynching. And I have examples of that in my book. A soft form of terrorism might be something like a firing, a blacklisting, book burning. These are events that created psychological trauma for their victims. And so in some ways, a firing and a blacklisting. This is a slow, soft form of pain, right? I mean, to feel that sort of insecurity, unable to secure work. And workers themselves and their allies described the blacklist as a form of terrorism. Okay, so that would be a soft form. A hybrid form, I offer one example of a hybrid form. This is what I call the drive-out campaign, also known as the run-out campaign. So this is how it worked. You might have Klansmen or business people, and they're upset about what they consider to be the presence of an outside agitator. They wanted that person gone. So they would approach that person or persons and say, you better be out of town by the time the sun comes up, or, you know, in 2 hours. And if that person complied, right, here we have a soft version, right? That is, that person's leaving voluntarily. Okay. Still, there's trauma there. But if that person did not, we might see kidnapping and even murder. Okay. So it was their choice, right? It could be bloodless, or it could be violent. And so I refer to that as a hybrid form. And so the subjects in my book engaged in all three types of what I call terrorism.
All right. So your first chapter looks at the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, during the Reconstruction period, when the Klan kind of first organizes itself. As you mentioned, no one's going to kind of argue that they weren't terrorists, but can you discuss how they fit into your idea of capitalists and how did they try to control labor?
Certainly. So I argue that the Klan functioned like a employers association. Okay, so it was a cross-class group of white people throughout the South who joined the Klan, but those who called the shots tended to be the downwardly mobile plantation owners, right? These are the folks who lost land and labor as a result of the Civil War and as a result of what W.B. Du Bois famously called the general strike. So the question then became, in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, how to maintain plantations, how to find labor. And the Klan really functioned in a way what the Klan did was it forced former slaves back onto plantations, back onto farms, back into kitchens. And so it was fundamentally about maintaining the ruling class in the South by using force. And so I'm primarily interested here in exploitation rather than hate. Many folks, civil rights groups who talk about the Klan historically and in the present, refer to hate groups. I'm not doubting the presence of hate, but what the Klan really wanted was they wanted workers to shut up and take it. Right. And of course they did kill. They used violence. They killed something like 3,000 people. But they're especially contemptuous of the so-called outside agitators, the carpetbaggers, the educators, because these people took the labor force, the formerly enslaved, and introduced them to ideas. Right. When Klansmen, planters, planter vigilantes, what they wanted was a stable workforce. So the Klan engaged in these three types of terrorism, right? Whippings, kidnappings on the hard end. They blacklisted, outside agitators, and they engaged in a lot of drive out campaigns against outside teachers, often white teachers. So fit in my overall story because they really showed the ability to combine management with vigilantism.
Okay, interesting. You next kind of turn to these organizations called Law and Order Leagues, and their organization by a man named J. West Goodwin. So can you talk about this character who makes occurring reappearances in your book, and what are these also these Law and Order Leagues that he is involved in?
Sure. So J. West Goodwin was a printer. He owned a print shop. He had served in the Civil War on the Union side. And he was very much a booster in his adopted home of Sedalia, Missouri, which is, you know, about a couple hours from, hour and a half from Kansas City in the mid to north west part of the state, part of Missouri. And he's sort of very much a booster. He's involved in business organizations in Sedalia, really wants to make the city a prominent place, not just in Missouri, but nationally. And he has problems with printers at his own shop who want to unionize, and he fires people. And then in 1886, we have this massive strike, Southwest Rail strike. And this was, you know, quite the confrontation involving, you know, thousands and thousands of protesters. And Sedalia was a hub of it. And so J. West Goodwin and a number of his colleagues form a Law and Order League. And what they did was they armed themselves and they helped escort scabs, that is strike breakers, to work on Jay Gould's big railroad. And he was, J. West Goodwin, during the course of it, used his newspaper to promote the Law and Order League movement, which expanded beyond the borders of Sedalia. So it emerged in a number of railroad towns throughout the Midwest, in Kansas, and there's a chapter in St. Louis. He singled out union leaders, including Martin Irons, who was the leader of the Knights of Labor, and the Knights of Labor ultimately lose this battle. But J. West Goodwin continues to denounce labor. He's remains active in the Law and Order League movement, and uses his paper to really stigmatize Martin Irons and others. So he's an organizer. He's a booster, very anti-labor, has had his own problems at his workplace, but wants to spread the message of anti-unionism well beyond the borders of Sedalia.
And these Law and Order Leagues, what besides outside Sedalia, what is their main function, objective?
Basically, they want to they boycott or they blacklist Knights of Labor members. They escort strike breakers. Are probably an intimidating force to organize labor. And so, what they do is they seek to promote a climate of law and order, and in the process of promoting themselves, sort of stigmatize unions as being law-breaking entities. And so they, they're very much the so-called best citizens, both from the private and the public sector, hold membership in these organizations. And it's a kind of a way to kind of promote, industrial stability and to insist that industrial stability and growth was incompatible with labor unionism.
All right. Can I ask, how did you run across the J. West Goodwin? He seems like such a fascinating character, and he doesn't have a Wikipedia page. So I was just wondering where you found him from. He's such a colorful character and involved in all these anti-labor movements in the U.S.
Yeah, so I had found a reference to him as being one of these leaders of both the Law and Order League and the Citizens Alliances. These are other anti-union groups, which we'll talk about in a bit. There wasn't much written about him. And so then I discovered that he owned and edited a newspaper, which is a wonderful source to really get to understand his thinking. And then I came across him in archives and in anti-labor union organization publications. And I realized that he's such an interesting figure. I found some other kind of wild things about him. You know, he would denounce. I mean, he would write about much more than labor. He would comment on social activities in Sedalia, including a play that he thought was the worst play that ever happened in all of Sedalia. And the actresses of the play then came and broke into his office and beat him they whipped him. And so this was quite embarrassing for him. Then he got beaten by the owner of the opera house the next day, and he had some serious medical problems for a while. But he continued to be this anti-union figure, and really an interesting figure who was just so central to the anti-labor union movement in the late 19th and early 20th century.
Yeah. So after you talk about Sedalia and the Law and Order Leagues, you move to Idaho and the steps taken by mine owners. What was happening in Idaho in the late 19th century, and why were workers going on strike?
Right. They were striking and they were locked out. They basically, there are two issues, really. The first is they wanted to have all workers, irrespective of the sort of job they did, they wanted to have the same wage. This is $3.50 a day. And so this workers form a union in the late 1880s, and there's a big confrontation in 1892 and another one in 1899. And so the first issue was really about, equity in workers and employers locked them out. They brought in non-unionist scabs. You see violent confrontations. And then the governor of Idaho declared martial law, federal troops and National Guardsmen come in, and they throw these people into these makeshift they throw protesting workers into these makeshift prisons known as bullpens, right? And so these were really cramped and disgusting. And in 1892, out of that, some workers talked about the need to form a bigger union. And the following year, in 1893, they formed the Western Federation of Miners, in part because of the repression that they experienced at the hands of both public and private anti-union figures. Miners are sort of skilled workers. They're hard to replace. And so most of the mines, with one exception, began to recognize the union. The one exception was the Bunker Hill and Sullivan Company. And so workers tried to unionize that for a long time. And in 1899, there was an explosion by a train filled with unionized workers. Some people said the workers did it deliberately. Others said it was agent provocateurs who were responsible. This led to another round of case of martial law, federal and national troops, and more of the bullpens. And so the question there was, workers wanted closed shops. They wanted employers to recognize the union. The Bunker Hill and Sullivan Company was unwilling to do it. Things escalated, and we see a tremendous amount of repression. And so I discuss how horrible the conditions were in these prisons. And incarcerated men died. The guards were very harsh, and racism played a part here. The federal government brought in black troops in an area where most of the workers were whites or immigrants and native born, and we know racism crossed class lines. But this was a case of really, I think, divide and conquer, really trying to inflame racial tensions on the part of the state. And so some of the grievances articulated by the incarcerated workers were, in fact, racist. But I'm sure that management and the state knew precisely what they were doing in inflaming that kind of racial tension. So this was an episode of incarceration, one might say mass incarceration, because they did not distinguish between violent and nonviolent workers in either 1892 or in 1899. And at least one historian has said this was the first use in 1892, the first time we see concentration camps. Okay. Other historians have said it was in Cuba, that is, the Spaniards introduced concentration camps in Cuba in 1897. But if we're to take if we look at this case, we've got 1892. So how about that, America?
What were the roles of some of the enablers in this case? I remember reading, talking about a lot about San Francisco being involved in this Idaho mine case.
Right. Well, some of the National Guard was led by this guy named Curtis, who was a vigilante in California in the 1850s. And so we see folks, this kind of fluid relationship between, law, those who engage in vigilante activities and those who will later join police departments or the National Guard. And so some of the folks who were involved in crushing these rebellions in northern Idaho had their own history in vigilante organizations, including some of the mine owners were involved in the Montana Vigilantes in the 1860s. This guy Curtis was involved in the San Francisco Vigilantes. So what I tried to do in this chapter, as well as in the book as a whole, is to trace this long history of vigilantism well into the turn of the century, and make the case that there's quite a bit of continuity here.
All right. From the mountains of Idaho, you go next to Florida and look at striking workers down in Florida and focus on a man, one of your terrorists named D.B. McKay. So can you talk about McKay and how did he terrorize his workers?
Yes. Yeah, so Tampa, Florida is an interesting case because what we see is this massive cigar worker strike organized by a group called La Resistencia, kind of an anarchist union. And these are Cuban, Afro-Cubans, some Italians, quite an eclectic group of workers who shut down many of these cigar factories. Tampa is a major cigar producing city. And you have a citizens association there, which is a very benign sounding elite organization. And one of the leaders is a guy named D.B. McKay, who was a newspaper owner and editor, who through marriage was very much connected to the cigar industry in Tampa, Florida. And what these folks do, members of them, is they break into the homes of about 13 members of La Resistencia. They put them on a boat and they bring them to Honduras, an island off of Honduras. They leave them there and then they come back. And those who were deported to Honduras eventually make it back. It takes a little while, a few weeks. After this happens, there are other employers who have their own labor problems, and they say, what a wonderful solution to the labor problem. Too bad it's illegal, kidnapping people and then deporting them. And so this made national news. And ultimately, the kidnapped victims make it back to Tampa. They contact the state, the Justice Department. The Justice Department do an investigation and conclude that there are no laws broken or that they couldn't find anybody responsible, which was nonsense. And they basically got away. So the enabler there was the district attorney from he was based in Jacksonville, and and they got away. And so this idea of kidnapping became contagious. Other employers used it, including in Colorado later, but Tampa was really one of the pioneering sites.
That's insane. So you also link this kidnapping events in Tampa to the Second Seminole War. Can you explain how this connection between capitalism and the Second Seminole War and kidnapping is connected?
Sure. Totally speculative, but I said, why not? Let's go for it. D.B. McKay was also what we might consider an amateur historian and wrote a lot about Florida's history, including the Second Seminole War. Now, for audience members who don't know about the Second Seminole War, it involved it happened from 1835 to 1842. One of the techniques used by the U.S. military was to kidnap the leaders of the Seminole Indians and then send them, kidnap the leaders to divide them from the rank and file, but ultimately to send the Seminoles to what is today Oklahoma. And so I speculated here. I said, you know what? In 1901, there were writers who said this Tampa kidnapping, this was the first time they were real pioneers. I said, no, wait a minute. One of the guys involved knew about the Seminole War, wrote favorably about the white soldiers and investors in Florida who were participants and beneficiaries of it. Let's think maybe this was on his mind in 1901, right? And so you can see parallels between, they're imperfect, but they're there, between the the government's role in kidnapping and deporting Seminole Indians with the kidnapping and deporting of immigrant laborers in 1901. So it's quite a big leap there, I know, but I felt the urge to say something original about a story that other historians have written about. So I'm not the first to write about this kidnapping. Others have done so, but I wanted to give it a different and a new and innovative spin.
Yeah. Definitely caught my attention.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Next you go to the emergence of citizens' alliances, and we come back to J. West Goodwin. So what were these citizens' alliances? What were these organizations? And what was Goodwin's role in the creation of these organizations?
Right. So at the turn of the century, during the so-called progressive era, which I call the misnamed progressive era because we have so much in the way of racism and union busting and eugenics and all of that, during that time, we see the anti-union movement, employers, sort of reframing the movement in a way that seemed more palatable and even progressive to ordinary people. And so one of the key features of this movement was the use of language, right? And so we see the emergence of a number of citizens' alliances, as well as the umbrella group, the Citizens Industrial Association of America. And so let's pause for a moment. One hears citizens' alliance. That doesn't sound especially threatening, right? And so we're all citizens. And so rather, Law and Order League sounds a little bit more ominous. Maybe not. I don't know. But citizens' alliance sounds pretty progressive, frankly. And the citizens' alliances really led by employers, but they included lawyers and clergymen, as well as anti-union workers and journalists. Rather than fight the so-called dangerous classes, they presented themselves as protecting the common man, the common people, right? For the protection of the common people was the slogan of the Citizens Industrial Association of America. So what that meant was protecting the non-union worker, the small business people. And they promoted what industrial relations scholars refer to as an open shop. An open shop workplace is a workplace where you don't have to be a member of a union to join. It's non-union and non-union. In practice, it meant union busting. Okay, it's about individualism as opposed to collectivism, right? About promoting the rights of the individual worker as opposed to the collective good of the working class. And so these citizens' alliances spread all over the country beginning in the very early part of the 20th century. And one of the main organizers was J. West Goodwin. J. West Goodwin was an organizer of the Law and Order Leagues in Sedalia and elsewhere. In the mid-1880s, 15 years later, right, he's a central figure in organizing citizens' alliances in places like Sedalia, of course, Scranton, Pennsylvania, Joplin, Missouri, Pensacola, Florida. He's all over. He claimed to have organized about 30 citizens' alliances, and he referred to himself as the Christopher Columbus of the citizens' alliance movement. Right, a real pioneer, and so this is an area of pride for J. West Goodwin to build these organizations led by businessmen that were anti-union, that promoted the open shop principle, but in practice blacklisted labor activists and sometimes engaged in vigilante violence.
Was Goodwin a driver of these, or did these organizations like know about him because of his past? Like, how did he get called in to go around and organize all of these?
That's a good question. I don't know exactly. I mean, we know that he was a prominent figure, at least in some circles, in the 1880s, right? So the Nation magazine and other sources wrote about him and wrote about Sedalia. So we can assume that information spread somehow. But in the case of Scranton, Pennsylvania, where he organized a big one, he just mentions that, a member of the Citizens Alliance in Scranton mentioned that, you know, we called him in, and then we had all these people who came, and we could not, find a room big enough to fit everybody who wanted to participate in this anti-union organization. And so he's well known. They call him, call him in to consult with employers who have a labor problem, during strikes, and he offers some advice. Now, I should add, these organizations were hyper-secretive, and secrecy is a theme we see throughout, from the Klan to the Law and Order Leagues, all the way up through the Citizens Alliances and beyond. So it's hard to get concrete information, but, I try to make informed assessments based on the information we do have.
Right. Silences of the archive. So you mentioned Scranton, which is kind of plays the central place in this chapter. Can you talk about how these citizens alliances worked in Scranton, Pennsylvania? They were specifically targeting the United Mine Workers Association. So what was the Citizens Alliance doing to the mine workers?
Right. So there was a series of strikes climaxing in 1902, the Great Anthracite Coal Strike. And at that point, there were citizens alliances in Wilkes-Barre, Hazleton, and Scranton. These are all the centers around the mining operations and hence the mining strike. And so they... it's hard to know for sure because the governor sent in the National Guard, and there was a lot of other public sector forces that were involved in violent strike breaking and that kind of thing, as well as the Coal and Iron Police. But the Citizens Alliance put out ads in the paper saying that they will give money to those who can identify workers who engaged in violent activities and that sort of thing. They also advertised themselves. They wanted to get members, and they talked about their commitment to law and order. I think some of whom were deputized by held membership in the Coal and Iron Police and whatnot. But a lot of it was framing, right, in the newspaper and through building the organization. That is, they wanted to offer an alternative to unionism and build a coalition of small business people and medium-sized business people, as well as workers who didn't want to hold union membership. So mostly public relations is what they did in Scranton.
And were they successful?
So the result of the strike led to... This is a massive strike. Anywhere I've heard 140, 150,000 workers involved. We have Theodore Roosevelt intervening. John Mitchell, the head of the mine workers, calls it off because Roosevelt forms a commission that sought to investigate conditions in the mines. And this is October. By March, the committee gives their reports. They reward the miners, 9-hour day instead of a 10-hour day, and a modest pay raise, but they don't offer them union recognition. So the open shop remains in place in the mines. So most historians look at this outcome and see it as a win for the workers. I would argue it was not a win for the workers, because what it did was it further legitimized the open shop principle, which is precisely what the Citizens Alliances fought for and continued to fight for. So after this, this strike and reward, which Theodore Roosevelt referred to as a square deal, the Citizens Industrial Association of America will put out a publication called The Square Deal. And they invoked Theodore Roosevelt, right? So Theodore Roosevelt becomes this figure who employers active in these anti-union organizations really loved. They really liked Theodore Roosevelt. So I'm cutting against a well-entrenched position, and that is that the mine workers themselves won. And I'm saying, no, this is a win for the open shop movement.
All right. So you, in the last chapter, you continue to look at the Citizens Industrial Association of America, and you specifically focus on a man by the name of Owen Wister. Who was Worcester and what role did he play in these associations?
Owen Worcester was the father of the Western genre of fiction, right? So he famously wrote a book called The Virginian, which is about this very subordinate cowboy who goes west, and he's very respectful to the big landowners and his boss, this judge. He hates rustlers. He would never engage in rustling. Rustling is the theft of cattle. And so the book is loosely based on the Johnson County War. The Johnson County War, at least parts of it, involved these stock growers from Cheyenne who went in with a 70-person kill list, 50 of them, and they ended up killing a couple of so-called rustlers. These were small landowners. The Wyoming Stock Growers Association wanted the land, and this was a public relations disaster for them. Okay, this looked really bad. They were indicted, but they were never ultimately tried, and they got off. And so this was a really terrible public relations disaster for the rural ruling class in Wyoming. Now, Owen Worcester, this privileged guy, Harvard educated, friends with Theodore Roosevelt, was friends with some of these members of the Wyoming Stock Growers Association, including some of whom had participated in the raid that had the backing of the governor, and even Benjamin Harrison sent in troops to support them. In any event, Owen Worcester heard stories about this, and he then wrote his book, The Virginian, which made the most privileged landowners look very good, okay? And so Owen Worcester was also a very conservative person. He would write articles in Saturday evening, different publications, I think Harper's, against unions and that kind of thing. And so in 1907, C.W. Post, Post Serial, who's a member of the Citizens Industrial Association of America, an anti-labor guy, hires Owen Worcester to be on the Citizens Industrial Association of America's Public Relations Committee, a propaganda committee. This is a 6 or 7 person committee. So Owen Worcester is one of the best known novelists in the world, right? And he works for this anti-union group doing public relations. And so his involvement in this group, I think, shows how prominent figures played a role in it. This was not a fringe. This is not some marginal group, right? We've got governors in it. We've got sympathy from presidents like Theodore Roosevelt. We've got big name manufacturers like C.W. Post. We've got Owen Worcester in it, right? And so what Owen Worcester essentially does is he basically celebrates the role of strikebreakers, of scabs, calling them heroes. Right? And so this is really important, I think, because one of the things the Citizens Industrial Association of America and citizens associations more broadly sought to do was to show that anti-union ideas were perfectly legitimate coming from ordinary people, right? That is, that the anti-union ideas were not these top-down, creations, but that, you know, this is about protecting law and order and good citizenship against these lawless unionists, right? And so to get one of the leading authors in the world to be a part of this, I thought, you know, I think it's a big deal.
Yeah, sounds like it. Yeah. Sounds like there is also a lot of overlap between your terrorists, your enablers, and your narrative makers. Is that something you came across a lot, and does that help explain why they were, you know, so well connected and able to assert their ideas?
J. West Goodwin ran it, you know, had his newspaper and was able to, you know, sort of disseminate his ideas while he also participated directly in these sort of union busting events. D.B. McKay, another newspaper man, was involved in the kidnapping. So yes, absolutely. There really was a lot of overlap.
All right. What do the case studies in your book tell us about the relationship between capitalism and terrorism during this era?
I think we must appreciate how violent and repressive American society was compared to other industrialized countries. And I think there's a relationship between the fact that the United States became the dominant industrial powerhouse in the world and the fact that it had the most repressive labor relations. And so those two things are connected. I'm not discounting the importance of entrepreneurialism, patents, the great education, you know, the great inventions and that kind of thing. That's part of the story. But this darker story, I don't think has been told as forcefully as I sought to tell it. And we can do ask questions. What would have happened if there wasn't as much violence, right? Would socialism take root? Would workers control manufacturing, right? These are questions we can ask, we can speculate about. But, you know, I really think that when push came to shove, you know, violence protecting private property was really key to sizable numbers of these business people who were involved in these employers associations.
And maybe just a question: do you think that that we see movements for unionizing today in lots of places like Starbucks? What kind of connections can you make between the tactics being used by Starbucks against their union or efforts to unionize and what we saw in the progressive era?
Right. Well, today it's obviously much less violent, excuse me. That doesn't mean there isn't violence that occurs. Right now it's the law. Biden brought Chris Smalls from Amazon to the White House. That's another campaign in addition to Starbucks. We have about 300 Starbucks where the workers have voted to unionize, but zero contracts here, right? The laws are designed to allow employers to basically get away with it, even though the National Labor Relations Board has fined or has forced Starbucks to rehire some of the people that they have fired. They're still fighting this thing. And so if we see mass movements of workers shutting down Starbucks everywhere, I think we will see a response from the state that could potentially be violent, right? What I'm imagining would be something involving, striking workers, preventing strike breakers from crossing picket lines, and that would initiate calls to the police who would then, when there are strikes, there's still, violence periodically. And so not as violent as it was back in the period I was interested in, that is the late 19th and early 20th century, but I could still imagine that happening. But in terms of ideology, I think there is considerable consistency, right? That is, employers in any period, right, want the ability to rule unilaterally. They don't want to share power. Right, they want to call the shots, and unions sort of threaten that. Right, that's about sharing power, and so the open shop principle remains very strong.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, so I'd like to ask you the traditional last question, and that is, what are you working on next?
So I'm doing a couple of projects at the moment. The first is about the second Klan, and I'm looking at the relationship between the second Klan and business. I'm finding a lot of overlap with the second wave open shop movement, where there's a lot of talk about, a lot of flag waving. The employers referred to the open shop movement in the 1920s as the American Plan, and the Klan was all interested in 100% Americanism, right? There's a lot of overlap there, union busting, that kind of thing. The strike during the Civil War involved about 4 million striking, former enslaved people. In 1919, there was a strike of 4 million workers as well. So, trying to find some parallels there. I'm also doing in the beginning stages of a project that looks more broadly at a history of extra-legal conservatism, as opposed to intellectual or institutional conservatism. So we look at the January 6th riot. We look at these anti-LGBTQ events happening in bookstores and libraries, anti-Black Lives Matter, violent protests at school board meetings, right? I want to historicize this and go all the way back to the anti-abolitionist mobs of the 1830s and 40s into the Klan. Look at anti-labor stuff again. Look at anti-civil rights organizations. And so I study people I don't like. But, you know, sometimes I'm afraid I might get Stockholm syndrome.
Really fascinating. So I'd like to thank you for joining me on the New Books Network. My guest was Chad Pearson. The book is Capital's Terrorists. It's out now from UNC Press. Thank you very much, Chad.
Thank you so much. It's a great honor to be with you.